Welcome to the Casterbris Doctor Who podcast, and that is a very rare thing indeed. I found this by mistake a couple of days ago when I was loading up my new mixing desk. That is a version of the Casterbris theme tune that we've never used before.
For a moment, you were just veering towards professional.
I know. And then I pulled it back from the brink and everything went back to normal. I like to think of that as our Delaware mix of the Casterbris theme tune. That drum and bass thing, I found it completely by chance. And I was thinking, why have we never used this? And I'm not a big fan of drum and bass, so that's maybe why, but I actually quite like it.
Yeah, it was quite something.
Refreshing?
Yeah, I'll take that.
Okay. This is James McLean. My name is Christian Corley. And we are here to discuss various topics related to or actually about Doctor Who. Depends how we feel, really. James, how are you doing? Is everything well with you?
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay as things can be these days.
Grand.
We are in the third part of a dark trilogy. 2022. We'll just see how it ends. Will it end well? Or will there be a call for more? Will there be sequels? I hope so. But I don't know. Sequel quality is variable, isn't it? Could be worse. Could be better.
There's so much you could unpack from that and go in all manner of different directions. And we weren't really going to do that, were we?
No. So if you've got your mixing board and you said just before you started that there's levers and buttons, but there are no knobs.
There actually is five knobs. They were hiding behind my laptop.
So I was just thinking, what, and this is not going down any stupid roads, but what is, and there are many answers to this, what is a knob in terms of, can you have a knob which is not a lever?
Yeah, I think you can.
Is knob a subset of another form of machinery?
Is it
of
just
a lever
not more
and a switch?
Sort of, I don't think there's an awful lot of difference historically speaking, but I think these days knobs are more suitable to more granular adjustments, whereas levers are more of a sort of put that in, pull that back, like you do with like a gear stick or a handbrake or switching points in the railway museum.
I was thinking as we should in the context of this deeply nerdy space of TARDIS consoles and knobs and levers. And I'm thinking like in the old 60s ones where you'd have that rack of levers with little knobs on the end, different coloured knobs. And
yeah,
and the door lever in the 70s, is that a knob or is it a lever? I mean, people, I don't know. And I just began thinking about this when trying to imagine your mixing desk. Was it, you know, where do knobs start and levers end? I don't know.
It's a good question. I can tell you one thing, though, which
is
will
it,
hurt
is it
everyone.
Christian?
No, well, okay. It leads me to do this. Which, criminally, is a button and not a lever. And, you know, that's a whole different conversation, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I feel like I'm co-hosting with a seven-year-old child who's just got a load of... I don't know. It feels like one of those. Do you remember in this sort of 80s where you'd have those little key rings and they'd have a load of buttons on with different sounds on? Do you remember them?
Those
little rubber. They'd be quite cheap and they'd have different noises. And it is like you have grown in size and so has your little key ring lever.
Well, do you know what? I had a Knight Rider watch in those days.
Oh, cool.
And it looked exactly like the watch on the TV. And what it did was every hour it would play a very sort of tinny chip tune version of the Knight Rider theme tune. But if you set the alarm, it wouldn't do it once, it would do it four times, each rendition lasting 15 seconds. And accidentally setting it, or accidentally enabling the alarm in the middle of school, led to much consternation from the teachers and amusement from the children, my fellow pupils. So occasionally I would do it on purpose, which is about as subversive as I got.
When you say it was like the one from TV, the TV one was just a digital watch, wasn't it?
It was a digital watch with two buttons on it. And this was a digital watch. I mean, I say that two buttons on it. They were probably as fake as the two buttons on my version.
Did it have Knight Rider plastered on the front of it?
Yes, I seem to recall it did.
I used to hate that as a kid.
Yeah.
It's like, I know you've got to brand your stuff, but stop it, because it's not branded on television. I have purchased your artifact for its similarity, the way it replicates what I see on television. On television, I do not see Buck Rogers slapped across the side of his starfighter. It's not there. Kit does not have Knight Rider 2000 stamped across the side of his door. You know, it used to really bug me. I spent many times trying to peel them off.
Ooh.
So it'd make more sense. But those were the days, weren't they?
Well, they were the days. The thing is, you know, I mean, apart from, unless you were like a little older than me, and James, you're the same age as me, I think, so a little older than you as well, or you had older siblings to hand you these things down. We had all these awesome toys from American shows in the 80s, but we didn't have anything from Doctor Who, because Doctor Who toys were like a 70s thing, and there was nothing in the 80s, apart from the Daypole.
Not till the back end, yeah.
Very odd.
But that was back end of the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
between those points, between those points, it was just things like a pottery police box, money banks,
or
tin stationery. That was the sort of thing that you would have.
But I remember we had some friends, and I don't know how they had them because they were younger than me, but they had the police box and the doctor and Canine. I don't think they had Leela, but if they'd, I'm not 100% certain on that. But I remember the most interesting thing about them was the sort of the dark thing in the TARDIS that you twist it round and then the doctors disappeared. Mm-hmm. Like that was a feature on the TV show. No, it wasn't. Mm. I remember being completely unimpressed by the dolls, but really liking the police box.
The police box was very good because by that point, the box was pretty much just a square with a lamp on the roof. You know, there was very little decal to it left since by 74. So it kind of fitted within the era in a way that it wouldn't have fitted later on. I used to have, I think it was later than that. It wasn't Denny Fish's. It was the Canine that had the little silver discs which you could put into the base, and it would say different things based on those discs.
Oh,
I recall.
Oh, I'd forgotten
about
that.
So it was slightly larger in scale than the Dennis Fisher one, but it was still fairly small. I remember having it and then being at an age where enlightenment to relative scale came upon me, and I realised he was far too small to be following me around. But before that, I hadn't really considered it. And I remember that sort of shift between thinking that this was just like Canine to realising this is far too small to be Canine. That listener is the sort of content that you've decided to listen to today. Of all days.
Yeah, while we're on the matter of Canine and being totally nerdy, there was a guy I went to college with who started building a canine out of wood and the remains of a big track. And it turned into a complete disaster for him. So, and he'd used the designs from there was a book, wasn't there, with construction designs in for like things from Doctor Who, I seem to recall, from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd photocopied, I think he'd got it from the local library, he'd photocopied a bit for Canine. So he was using that to build his Canine from wood. Anyway, he gave up basically, and I took it on. It didn't last very long. It went in the bin within a couple of years.
I mean, there's some quite awkward angles on Canine. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's not as easy as one probably thinks it is.
Well, it's been done countless times since then in this sort of modern era with like Raspberry Pis and Arduinos and things and 3D printing and other lightweight fabrication techniques. It's a lot easier to do.
But yes, it's not an easy one. But I do love that. And I think we've said this before. It is fascinating watching people do the research to build these things and where they locate the parts and the pieces and the, as we've said, with things like TARDIS builders and people finding the right Fresnel lamps for the roofs, and even down to things like Blake 7 with ORAC and then sort of literally trying to find all the pieces of plastic and wires to match what was inside that transparent Perspex crate. It's fascinating, but yeah, it's got so much more professional now than it was in the 80s. Now it's as Terra Nova would show us, our older co-host, you know, the accuracy of replication is incredible.
It's probably a good time to mention, whilst we're talking about that, that there's a couple of guides on Castorbis that you can we'll link to in the show notes for sonic screwdrivers and TARDIS building. So you probably check those out whilst we're still on this topic, and then we can move on to the other thing that we were going to talk about, which was James.
Yeah, you're talking with someone who's got very low working memory. It was something to do with... I have bad working memory. It was something to do with Doctor Who and Doctors. Oh, it was... No, it's gone again.
Was it Matt Smith?
Yes, it had. Well, that was one of the things. I was thinking of... We were talking about... Yeah, it was about this idea, because there's been a few more rumblings, hasn't there, about how Russell T. Davis is going to shape his new era in Doctor Who.
Yes.
And there was a lot of rumblings now going on, which sort of reinforces what we've been saying for the last few months, since last October, I think, that that he'd be looking to sort of mirror some of the sort of more contemporary multi-component franchises that we're seeing, like with that Disney's doing with Star Wars and Marvel, and DC's doing at the moment as well. And that was kind of where we thought he would go, and that's kind of where it sounds like it's going. And I was kind of surprised on Twitter at the amount of backlash to this. I thought people would be like, oh, that's kind of cool. But it was kind of a shock and horror. And I wasn't sure whether it was a shock and horror because it felt like Doctor Who was, you know, to use a tabloid term, sort of like milking itself by in the same way that people see Star Wars as milking itself and all these.
Is it blue milking itself?
Blue milking itself. But there seemed to be a lot of resistance to it. And it surprised me because you've got Big Finish, which is, you know, the epitome of doing that, spreading its wings and sort of drawing on every aspect of the franchise and often pulling those things together in different ways. And even Russell T. Davis's original era was doing a lot of that. There was a lot of crossovers, a lot of combinations. You know, end of season 4 was very much drawing together all his strands before he left.
Yeah.
Sarah Jane Adventures, Torchwood, past characters from the show all coming together for the big Dalek finale.
Well, I mean, it's basically Endgame and Infinity War and Endgame put together, isn't it? Really,
Absolutely. Yeah, and they were doing that before Marvel did. Perhaps not to the same grandiose scale, but it surprised me that people were kind of shocked by this idea when, as I say, to some degree, Doctor Who have been doing it before. Before certainly the Disney Marvel has. I mean, Marvel's been doing crossovers, you know, for decades.
Yeah.
And as we know, Doctor Who's been doing them before that. We've had K-9 and Company as well. We've had spin-offs that have emerged over the years as well.
And also that you've got the comics in Doctor Who magazine, which has always introduced characters and then left them hanging to be pulled back in at some other point where there's more than one sort of big event sort of thing going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've even got sort of that sort of multiverse or expanded universe nods within things like Night of the Doctor, with McGann's references to Big Finish.
Yeah.
So it does surprise me a little, and I just wondered whether what it was that people didn't like. As I say, was it that sort of feeling of their product being overly commercialised, or was it a feeling of fear that it wouldn't work? I mean, there is, as Gareth said to us the other week, which was a very good point, with Doctor Who, you do lack that stable universe to sort of really draw upon in a way that you have a stable universe in Marvel, where everything's set pretty much in the same era, pretty much set on Earth, or is acknowledges Earth, and you can sort of build around that. While with Doctor Who, you don't have that set structure. So
you would need something like Unit or Torchwood, wouldn't you? Maybe.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they're the obvious ones. But then, I mean, as I was saying to you the other day on a social media communication, that there is a sort of argument that, and again, this probably won't win me any fans, but with the whole idea of the Ruth era extending before William Hartnell, you've got a position now where you could have multitudes of doctors and you could just do, without even acknowledging it within continuity, a special in the same way that you do a detective special of Frost or something, which is just a doctor played by a celebrity or, you know, an actor, which would draw people in because they'd be curious to see how they would play the role.
Mm.
Landing in the TARDIS, which would be a police box, because we know Ruth's TARDIS was a police box, and having a Doctor Who adventure. So you could, in a sense, do multiple things with the franchise and expand it outside of the central main timeline with stories which are just one-offs, which aren't just attempts to create new spin-offs, but are in a lone sort of limited features.
Yeah, yeah.
Which could be quite interesting.
And it's not really... this wouldn't be the first time it had been done. Although, obviously, with Doctor Who, admittedly, it happened accidentally in 1996. That wasn't the intention, to just make that episode and then leave it. They were hoping that it would lead to a series.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you could also argue, obviously, the attempt just before Davis took over as well, the internet version.
I was indeed about to. Richard Paul Cornell's Scream of the Shulker with Richard E. Grant, yeah.
Absolutely. Or, I mean, you can even go into the books as well, into the books lines. It's the Nth Doctor, isn't there?
Yep.
Which, again, has Lance Parkin's brain certainly for once.
Yes.
That again, sort of, it does exactly this. It gives you a deliberately unspecified Doctor to follow their adventures on Gallifrey. And I think that could be a quite interesting way of taking Doctor Who forward, where you can have a Doctor Who, which is, you know, your main serial, but you can have one-off specials, because the format is fairly fixed. Plus, a Doctor lands somewhere, there is a problem, Doctor fixes it, Doctor goes. So you have a sort of bookended project which you can just drop in with anyone. So if you wanted, you know, there was all this conversations about Hugh Grant could do it. He'd be somewhere before William Hartnell, so you wouldn't have to worry about continuity, timelines. It wouldn't even have to reference any of that. It would just simply be a standalone Doctor Who adventure that if you wanted to toss it into a timeline, it'd be pre-Hartnell. But that's all you'd need to know. So they could be simple, straightforward, interesting shows where you get to watch a fresh face do the role. So I think that could be one way it could work without sort of having to tap into, you know, River Song series or the Missy series or, you know, something which is a little obvious or done by Big Finish already.
The Doctor cast out of Gallifrey, like Thor from Asgard.
Yeah, but I mean, that actually is quite interesting. That would be but that's the sort of thing you could do. And I think that would have some legs in it. I mean, it'd almost be like, have I got news for you with your guest presenter of the week?
Yeah.
I think that would work. I don't think that you'd do multitudes of those. I still think that, as we said with Gareth, saying, you know, we were talking about, you know, the McGann is an obvious one. I still quite like the idea of doing something slightly trippy, like a Cyberman who is a detective or something like that, you know, a rogue Cyberman, I think would be fun. And sort of playing with some of the established concepts of some of the monsters, I think is always enjoyable. I think, you know, the Paternoster a lot, in some ways they irritated me, but I kind of like the idea at the same time. You know, it's fun. It kind of feels like one of the few times that Doctor Who tapped into the sort of thing you'd see in Doctor Who Monthly, because it felt very much like an Absalom Dak world, where, you know, a Centauran and a Silurian are working together with a human in Victorian London. That kind of feels like a more idea.
There's a funny thing about Stephen Moffat's era of Doctor Who. There is a lot of opportunities for spin-offs that weren't taken. Instead, they went with Class.
Yes, that was a weird choice. But
I've just finished watching Coupling. I never watched Coupling the first time around. I think I watched caught a couple of episodes, but I never sat down and watched it properly. So we just watched it on BritBox and got to the end, the final episode. And that's possibly the most profound thing Stephen Moffat's ever done. The final episode of Coupling. I can't believe it. I was like, sure, Stephen Moffat couldn't have written it. Oh, he did. Bloody hell. It was really good. It's probably not spoilers to describe what happens, but basically the main couple have a child and it ends with that. But it's just this one line of dialogue right at the end. You think, flipping heck, Stephen Moffat, wow.
Oh, yeah, he's a talented writer. There's no doubt about that. But yeah, I think that could be interesting. And equally, it means that you can also draw in guest writers or guest producers, guest director who might work on a set or on a set of one-off stories. I think there's definite potential. I've always felt there's more potential, and I wonder whether it will actually happen as America shows, and Japan has been showing for years, that sort of this sort of crossover and sort of multimedia approach to characters and combining IPs is got a lot of potential to it. And like, you know, I think it'd be kind of fun to have an episode, a standalone episode of like Father Brown and Doctor Who, you know, where you actually literally cross over BBC products and create a story which mixes. I think that, I know people would say that's crass, and if you think it's crass, you don't have to watch it. It wouldn't be something I would say, like, we'd have an episode in the serial canon of Doctor Who where Father Brown is there, or some, I don't know.
Doctor Who in Shakespeare and Hathaway.
It'd just be a one-off special with a combined franchise thing, and just see how it plays out. And yeah. I think that would draw people in to watch that sort of drama, because it does have legs. It does give a kick. And the only downside to it, and this is kind of where I think we see a downside in the States with what Sony's suffering now, and I think there's a risk that Disney's Marvel may suffer it too, is the more that you combine and create the excitement through combinations, unexpected combinations, when you go back to your normal stuff, the normal stuff looks a lot less interesting. So, you know, after you've done No Way Home and had multiple Spider-Men, your next one with one Spider-Man, is that going to carry the same sort of engagement, the same sort of thrust?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you sort of, and you know, like if you're saying, like with the Morbius vampire thing that Sony's just released with Jared Leto and Matt Smith, which is not getting favorable reviews, and a little bit of me is like, well, you're doing a Spider-Man film with no Spider-Man when you've just had the last thing was a Spider-Man with extra Spider-Man. So how is that going to tap into your audiences? And I suppose that is always the risk when you do all these massive connections and crossovers, is that can you still create engagements when you don't do that? And I think you can, but I think it's something to be mindful of. I just think it's some interesting sort of conversations about where Doctor could go. And I was just surprised that people were very, I don't
resistant?
Know, warm to it. Mm. Yeah, and resistant. So why are we always resistant?
Well, I mean, we don't appear to be resistant. And I know we have been, I certainly have been in the past.
Yes.
But I think it gets to a point where, you know, the show does certain things. Maybe it's doing some of them right, but maybe it's not doing the things it needs to do right. And maybe you think, well, in the end, it is just a TV show, and there's opportunities to do all manner of different things with a TV show. So why not go and explore them rather than trying to do the same thing over and over again? Companion falls in love with Doctor, travels through time and space, unrequited love or real love, who knows, something will tear them apart, with any number of combinations, and Daleks coming back to life. And it's 2022. Doctor Who came back in 2005. That's 17 years last week. And it's been back now longer than it was away. So it's probably, if there was a time for it to try and do something different, and it's kind of been working to a sort of template that was even under Chibnall, who obviously has the benefit of Broadchurch under his belt. There is some elements of that, and there's been the long form storytelling attempts with his era, but at the same time, it does regularly fall back to the sort of the Rose template of Davies, of certainly his first series. Now, bringing the same guy back to oversee a new era, a new way of doing the show, seems like a smart idea. So let's just go with it.
I mean, I'd be more resistant to it if it was something that happened all the time. And again, it felt like an old approach which had been proven to work or didn't work. This feels like something where the show and the BBC, to a degree, are tapping into contemporary movements within media industry and trying to replicate success. And that, to me, seems sensible for a show which, as you say, is 17 years old in its most newest incarnation.
and needs to find new ways of working itself to keep itself viable. And I'd say the same for Jodie. I know a lot of people didn't like it. I know when it was announced, I was a little resistant to it. I know you're a little resistant as well. But I'm very pleased that they went and did it, because, again, it was something the show hadn't done before. And that's what you need to do. I mean, imagine if we'd had another year of another... I know people are calling for him now, but for, you know, I know people say, oh, Michael Sheen would have been brilliant, but would it have just felt like another variation on Capaldi? Do you know, the show is meant to sort of try and push boundaries a bit. And they did that. Whether it was successful or not, that's a different question.
Well, Michael Sheen says it's not him, and I hope it's not him.
Yes, yeah,
I don't dislike him.
And I like
Michael.
Don't think he's
right.
So same here. I just think he would just be a bit obvious. I think sometimes you need something which is going to take you out of your comfort zone to make the show. That's, you know, that's where the show's been successful. You know, Tom Baker was nothing like John Pertwee. People seem to forget that.
Yeah.
And they took a big gamble, which, as we know and we've said before, wasn't wholly, you know, embraced initially either.
Oh, yeah.
You've got to take gambles. You can't just go with what's most safe, especially if you want your show to survive. And I think that's the other thing which gets me a bit with the resistance to Davis's new approach, is that, again, it's about trying to keep the show relevant. And that is important. And if that means tapping into... So, I mean, they might turn around and say Hugh Grant's the next Doctor or Martin Sheen. And if they do that, I'd be like, that's disappointing for me. But I imagine that's to maximize global reach. And if maximizing global reach keeps the show vibrant and valuable in the BBC's eyes, that's probably good.
Well, it's the sort of thing they should be doing at this stage, isn't it? If they, you know, with the whole Bad Wolf thing and Sony Pictures and Sony Television Pictures, big pardon, and Russell T Davies, and aiming for this sort of mixed universe thing. I don't know what the best way of putting it is, but yeah, it has to be a big name, doesn't it? Or an up-and-coming name.
I think it's also a shame, like you say, the way that they are still replicating bits of the old show. I mean, like as you said, sort of the Yaz and the Doctor, which I do acknowledge that there are a lot of fans out there which are really enjoying it, and that's great. But to me, it did kind of feel like we've been down this territory before, because you know that the Doctor's not going to go down a route. So there's not a will they, won't they. It's just a won't they. So there's limited trajectory on these sort of things. And even when they did the they will with River Song, that never really worked either. But I suppose at least you could argue it was something different.
The funny thing
I've been
about
watching,
that,
yeah,
I've
go on.
That episode, the last episode with River Song,
mm-hmm.
I don't particularly like it, but that moment when she realises who he is, I'm praising Stephen Moffat again. It's a very good moment, and it doesn't save the episode, unfortunately, because I think it's a very, very, very silly episode. But that moment is very watchable on YouTube.
I think the funny thing is, I don't think it's about age. I know some people go, oh, it's because Capaldi's an older man. I kind of felt that Capaldi and Song work better. They have a better dynamic.
Mm.
Probably because there is a sort of slight... I mean, his character is a sort of, obviously, a very... I wouldn't say curmudgeon. He's not a grumbler. He can be very bright and enthusiastic. But I could imagine her character sort of balancing with him more in a way than Matt Smith's would.
Yeah.
With Matt Smith, it just didn't work for me, and nor did it work with David Tennant. But with Capaldi, I could see it. But yeah, the problem with the episode was the episode. The last bit with her spending 20 years with him, that was fine. But yeah, the episode itself was bad. I mean, something I've been watching another South Korean drama, and they're playing a storyline in it, which is very simple, been done many times before, but would be something that I would drop into something like Doctor Who, which is they have a zombie in it, which is looking to find answers and is slowly falling apart as it's trying to do so. It's a side story. It's not the main story. But I was just thinking, you know, having a companion in the Doctor, which does have a finite life, which is part of that story, that the trajectory of their story is to find out something before they end, and the Doctor's there to help them do that. It's a bit of a dark tale, but the way you could do it could still be fun.
Mm.
But it would be something different to this sort of... Because the problem with Will They, Won't They is that Will They, Won't They has an outcome. for audiences. The audience want them to have it. They don't want it to be a not. They want it to be a will. And you can't deliver that in Doctor Who. But something where you don't have that trajectory, where it can stand alone as a story in itself, with a beginning, middle, and end, the meet, the journey, the farewell, is something which contemporary Doctor Who doesn't really do.
It's not only is it difficult in Doctor Who, it's very difficult in other shows. I mean, look at probably the beginning of this thing, this whole will they, won't they sort of aspect of storytelling. I mean, it's Moonlighting, isn't it?
Yeah, Moonlighting's normally... I mean, I think there's probably other earlier examples, but it's certainly the one where I think networks really felt
And it really didn't work after that, did it?
No.
And the same can be said of other things where they've done that and it doesn't... It works occasionally, but in most cases, if a couple isn't already together when something starts, putting them together in that kind of, will they, won't they, get the outcome, it's almost always a disappointment in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. People want to see the build-up to a relationship, but the relationship itself is often quite tedious. I mean, there's been some examples where they've managed to do, which I thought at the time was quite clever. I think I've said this before, like Farscape, where they have the will they, won't they with Crichton and Aaron, but they sleep together within the first season, which I remember at the time was like, oh, they've done the deed already. Aren't we meant to be sort of continuing a cycle of them not doing the deed for like three seasons till it ends? But they get over that and then they carry on the story of the will they, won't they. And it's quite a clever way to sort of perpetuate something. Acknowledge attractions and interests, so you've not got that terrible boring trope of them neither of them quite finding their paths meet at the right time to acknowledge their feelings, which is what the will they, won't they likes to do. So there's ways to subvert it, but yeah, I think with things like Doctor Who you just it's just not feasible, because you just, and as you say, outcomes are just never satisfying. So for Doctor Who, I think for arcs, rather than going back to the very staple, as you say, the question of who does he fancy, which seems to have popped up far too often, I think where the Doctor works best and has never really been utilised enough is as a healer, as a helper, as a guide. And they sort of kind of started doing it with Ace and the Doctor, this idea that he was preparing her, he was giving her experience, he was shaping her to become either a better person or maybe a Gallifreyan, as the law might have gone. But that's the sort of thing we don't tend to get, and I think that's something Doctor Who could do really well. And that would be something I would like to see happen, rather than another will they, won't they. Someone in distress, help them through a storyline which helps them through that, and the end of that storyline is them actually... We'd see it in a standalone episode, but we never see it as a character arc. And it's odd. You almost had it again with the Whittaker era, I guess, with Graham and Ryan, had the potential for that.
Yeah, yeah.
But they never felt, it all got lost.
As so many things tend to in Doctor Who.
Not even
in the past few years, but just over the years of all of Doctor Who, there's been sort of ideas of doing things that have never been really, maybe appeared to be quite good ideas at the beginning, but they were never followed through.
Absolutely. Once they go, they never really come back either. Not properly. Even in the new series, Gallifrey appears, disappears, reappears, has to be found, disappear, reappear. No one really, there's never any real sort of cohesiveness to those storylines.
And if you, there's also this sort of the Gallifrey in the books as well, which is destroyed at one point, isn't it? Or hidden.
Yeah.
In another one, now is that a different hiding of Gallifrey, or is that the same? How many times has Gallifrey gone now?
Yeah. How many time wars has it had?
Yeah.
Skyro, how many times has Skyro been destroyed? It's something Doctor Who lacks, and that's fine, because it's a flaky universe, and its argument is that time is variable and stuff can change, which is great, but it makes it very hard to actually create anything stable. But that might change.
It might do.
I
was reminded while we were talking of a video that went on YouTube a few years ago, a good few years ago now. It was back when we had an actual Casterbis website that did news and things like that. Is oh, Craig, I've accidentally clicked play on that. Just pause that. It's the anime Doctor Who animation that someone created.
With the
very sort of Third Doctor and Master and Daleks and Cybermen. I always thought it was absolutely wonderful. And I think it's a good example, not in terms of how it's executed, although I would not say no. Oh, there's a Brigadier in it as well. I would not say no to a Doctor Who like this. In all honesty, I quite like it. I love the way it looks. But that whole idea of these sort of all these things crashing in at once and having absolutely no real sort of canonical relevance. And I kind of think as well that it goes back to a chat I saw at one of Gareth Kavanagh's events many years ago with Paul Cornell. Paul Cornell was kind of ahead of the pack on this, and a lot of people didn't agree with him. But, you know, in hindsight and with the benefit of everything that's happened over the years, and certainly with the Chibnall era, it was this idea that there isn't really a canon. And I think maybe he's right on that, that we have a canon and maybe we shouldn't, but it's not, there's no consistency to this canon, is there? It's very much a head canon for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good thing. I mean, we know that that's largely to do with the way the way that Doctor Who's been produced as a British production without that sort of engagement from the actual production to create canon. But it also fits, as we say, the way that time is changeable. And now we have conversations in the last season of a multiverse, which allows the space as well to, if you need to canonise your stuff, you kind of can, but you don't have to. I remember on Outpost Gallifrey, I think it was around the time that Cornell's, was it around about that time? Human Nature came out.
And on TV?
Conversations on TV, yeah, and yeah. About canon. And, you know, he was very much, I remember making mention of it, and he was sort of like doing the sort of emoting nod. And he's said this many times before and since, you know, that things like the Time War is your buffer. And you can,
yeah,
if you need it. But I agree with you. I think it's a show which, without the Time War, when you've got time and it's all about time changing, what is canon? Can you have a canon when things, you know, split, change, alter anyway? Which the show has shown many times. I know it's now come up with various ways to justify some things as fixed events, as nexus points, things that can't be changed, and all this kerfuffle and waffle. But, you know, ultimately the show will override that if it needs to later, and it won't care about it. I mean, we're just waiting for the Doctor to go back to New York in the 40s, and we know it will happen. And then people will go, but surely Amy and the Doctor, he can't go back there because of the instabilities, and the show won't care. And as you say, I think once you get to a show of this length, you've kind of, A, the show's not got to care, and also the audience has got to kind of stop caring. It's like Spider-Man. I've been reading some of these Spider-Man issues recently. I was kind of interested. I watched No Way Home, and then I've watched some of the old Spider films, you know, the Tobey Maguire and the Andrew Garfield, and I was just dipping into the comics. I was like, oh, I wonder where the whole Mary Jane Peter Parker thing is now, because last I remember back in like 2008, they had to make a decision with the godly Mephisto to basically cancel the marriage so it never existed, because the editors wanted to move on and felt Spider-Man should be single. And so they created that sort of ridiculousness. And I was like, where is it now? And so I was just reading old comic back issues. And you look at that, and the audience, even though there's a canon to Spider-Man, has to acknowledge that the canon doesn't work. Because you go back to the early points of his relationship with Mary Jane, and they've still got things like the Vietnam War going. You know, they're just talking about World War II. And yet every time it's contemporary, you can't ignore the fact that comic canon cannot work because it's inconsistent and yet consistent with our history. And you've got to let it go. And it's the same with Doctor Who, isn't it? To a degree, you just got to enjoy it and let it go. I'm sure there'll be many Spider-Man fans who will know how that is justified. I'm sure there are ways with their various crises that both Marvel and DC do. But yeah. It's a weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I I don't know. I suppose Doctor Who has a slight advantage in being a time traveller and immortal, but other than that, yeah, it's you just have to deal with it, don't you? And you can't rely too much on canon with something, you know, that started off in 1960, whatever, as a teenager and who has aged about 10 years. It doesn't really work, does it?
I mean, I kind of enjoy them not being canon. I sometimes find when they do try to canon it, it just sort of breaks it more. You know, I can take the idea that Clara goes back and knows all the generations of the Doctor, or River Song has met all the generations of the regeneration of the Doctor, and I don't know. That's fine. I can even sort of vaguely sort of drop in Twice Upon a Time and the slightly old, the slightly different looking Doctor, First Doctor in that. I think it becomes a problem when you try to over canonize and suddenly you have a new Ben and Polly there. You don't look anything like Ben and Polly, and you're just like, why are you doing this? You don't have to have them there. They don't need to be there. I can accept that this is either that this show isn't a canon, but sometimes when you sort of push it in your face, it somehow just breaks it a little more than you, and it's just like, you don't need to. You just don't need to be doing this at all. You don't need to worry so much. But they do that. I don't know. I mean, Star Trek's taken a more novel approach in the last few years with its in new era. And there was like the Star Trek Discovery, where they have an episode with a young Spock and it refers back to the pilot episode of the 60s version. And it's a weird acknowledgement where there's a previously on Star Trek for this new episode, which had bits of the old 60s episode that they look at in the show, but they look at it, you know, where the planet looks really good and the effects look really good and Spock's little Nimoy suddenly and not the new guy. And it's like, why have you clashed these two things together? And I know you can say, well, the audience know that it's just a TV show, but there is that line where they know it, but they don't want to know it. And if you start poking that too much, it just becomes frustrating because it suddenly feels less special. So I think there is a line there, isn't there, between audiences knowing that it's just a load of, you know, television, and also wanting it to be more. And I think Doctor Who has this space and opportunity for it to do both by being something which has serialization to it. You're following the journeys of the Doctor, but the world of the Doctor is constantly in flux. So, you know, anything can happen and anything can change, and that allows you to do new stories. But it does kind of drop. I suppose the only canon you have is the canon of his life. But even that is probably subject to being changed through temporal events occasionally.
Which is a good time to bring this Casterbus podcast to an end. And we'll speak to you again soon. Until then, it's goodbye from us.